What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Welcome back, friends. I don't know what else to say. I hope you guys are having a good week. I know a lot of people said that they were like crying listening to Monday's listener stories.
Aww.
And like same, because like there were some really impactful stories. And I mean, you guys heard us crying on the episode if you listened. Yeah. But if you haven't listened, go listen to that. And even if you don't like normally like listener stories, highly
go
recommend
listen to that one.
It's listener stories 25. Because it's there were some really like incredible stories, so
yeah,
just putting that out there. I've also recently seen a couple of people asking when we are going to put out new merch / reinstate our merch on our website.
Yep.
It is coming, I promise. We are working on some really like fun things for merch, so stay tuned. It is coming. And you will know when it comes. So
yes,
stay tuned for that. I know that's kind of vague, but it is coming. But with that, I have a survival story today, and I think it's a really impactful story, and it's truly like an incredible story. So
yeah,
we will just dive right in.
Okay.
On July 7th, 1979, Mary Stauffer and her 8-year-old daughter were crouching behind a parked car on a residential street, waiting for police to arrive. They were chained together and terrified that authorities wouldn't get there in time.
Oh my God.
So what led to this moment, and what were they doing there? It is a roller coaster, a wild story, so let's get into it.
Okay.
Mary Stauffer was born in West Duluth, Minnesota in 1944, and she had two siblings. And when she was 10 years old, the family moved to nearby Hermantown. After graduating from Hermantown High School, Mary attended Bethel College in 1965. And while in college, she met Irv Stauffer, who was a seminary student at Bethel College. So the couple started dating, and eventually they got married after Mary graduated. And then, but Irv was still in school. So during the 1967 to 1968 school year, they actually ended up going on a mission to the Philippines.
Okay.
And this was just the first of many that they would go on. Mary was a teacher. So from 1965, when she graduated, to 1967, when they left on the mission, she taught ninth grade at Ramsey High School.
Okay.
And then they left on the mission. And when they came back, she went back to teaching in Minneapolis. Eventually, Irv actually became a Baptist minister, and he was asked to pastor a congregation in Polk, Nebraska, so the couple decided to move there. And okay. They were originally only planning to stay in Nebraska for like a year or two, but they ended up having two children, a daughter Beth and a son Steve. So they ended up staying in Nebraska for 5 years, as you know, they were like having their kids and like,
yeah,
you know, starting their kids' lives there.
That's understandable.
In 1975, the entire Stauffer family, so Mary, Irv, and the two young children, went back to the Philippines for a 4-year mission. And during their time there, they started several new churches in the central islands of the Philippines, and it sounds like they did a lot of incredible work. Yeah. So they were there until 1979, and when they came back, they moved back to Minnesota. In May 1980, they were preparing to leave on another 4-year mission with their 8- and 6-year-old children.
Okay.
So May 16th, 1980 was literally the day before they left. It was a Friday. It was a very busy day because, you know, last minute preparation. You're about to for 4 years. So they were running errands, and just it was a very busy Friday, as I smack my mic because that's just how busy
it was. Talk with our hands. Yeah.
Yeah. But that morning, 36-year-old Mary took Steve, who was 6 years old, to get a haircut before dropping him off for afternoon kindergarten.
Oh, I'm getting scared. I'm getting nervous.
Oh. I know. But total side note, not relevant to the story, but I remember it made me think of this when I was doing my research. When I was in kindergarten, we called it early birds and late birds. That was like what Aww, the like cute. Morning and afternoons were yeah. called. I don't know if that's a thing anymore in kindergartens, but I always thought that was Aww, really cute.
That's cute. Yeah, that is cute.
But yeah, so she took Steve to school and then she brought 8-year-old Beth to go get her haircut. So they went to a salon in Roseville, Minnesota, and it's a city. Roseville is a city in the suburban part of St. Paul, which is one of the twin cities in the state.
Okay.
Mary and Beth went to Carmen's Beauty Salon, got Beth's haircut, and then were heading back out to the parking lot to get into the 1973 Ford LTD that she was driving thanks to the church lending it to the family. Mary was unlocking the passenger side door of the car. Again, this is 1980, so automatic car locks.
Not a thing.
You have to go and like physically put the key in and unlock it. So that's what she's
honestly,
doing.
I'm surprised she even locked her doors because she lives in the Midwest, number one, mm-hmm. and it's the 70s or 80s, I guess, at this 80s, point. Yeah. So
yeah, true.
But yeah.
But she had locked her car door, and so she was unlocking the car door when a man approached
them.
No,
stop.
And this was like a busy intersection. So at first, as the man was walking up, Mary didn't think much of it, thinking right. like, oh, he's probably asking for directions. Mm. But when he got close to the mom and daughter duo, the man pulled a gun and pushed it into Beth's side. He said, I need a ride. And Mary later recalled that she was like ready to give him the car keys. She was like ready to be like, take here, it. Take the car, yeah. take anything you want. But that's not what he wanted. He wanted the two of them to get into the car and drive him.
Which is scary because that means his intentions are not, I need a ride.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. And he had a gun. So they followed his instructions. Yeah. They got into the car. And the man started directing Mary on where to drive. Mary was very devout in her faith. So she tried to appeal to the man with her faith. Mm. She later remembered that she told him, quote, we are Christians and our God specializes in helping people in trouble, trying to like appeal to him. But yeah. he was having none of it. And he told her to shut up and drive.
Yeah.
So Mary kept driving at this man's instructions. And when a police officer happened to pull up behind them at a stoplight, he threatened that if the police car turned in the same direction as they did, he would shoot Beth.
What? Like, she has no control over that. Like, he's just driving. What?
Yeah. But that just shows you how, like, unhinged off the cuff he was. Yeah, unhinged. That's the right word, not off the cuff. But he was just, like, kind of almost, like, so intense about it.
Right. Like, trying to scare her.
Yeah. So he forced Mary to keep driving and eventually leaded them to a remote wooded area. Lead it is not a word.
I know. I was just going to let you fly with it. I was like, it's fine.
He led them to a remote wooded area.
Okay. Gosh.
And once they were in an area where no one could see them, he forced them out of the car and he bound them together so that he could have more control over them. And then he basically shoved them into the trunk of the car and he got into the driver's seat.
And her daughter is 8, you said, at this point?
Mm-hmm. 8 years old.
Oh my gosh, how terrified she must have been.
Yeah. So the man drove for a little while. At one point, he actually stopped because Mary and Beth had been praying pretty loudly, and he was angry that they were being so loud. So he, like, pulled over, told them to be quiet, and ended up taping their mouths shut so that they couldn't keep doing that.
What in the world?
He then drove to an undeveloped area near Roseville, which was the town that they were abducted from, so they weren't that far away.
Yeah.
And he was heading to pick up his own car from a nearby lot, but before he did that, he pulled over in another remote area and he opened the trunk to put the car's spare tire on top of Mary and Beth, likely because he wasn't sure if the area where his car was would be completely empty, so he wanted to make sure that, like, if he opened the trunk, they wouldn't be, like,
seen.
Obvious. Yeah. He also, when he did this, noticed that Mary had been able to partially free Beth from her restraints, so he tied her back up. Jeez. And as he was doing this, two young boys approached the car out of curiosity.
Oh, no.
One of the boys stayed at the front, but the other, 6-year-old Jason Wilkman, went around the back to see what was happening, because he's like, what's going on?
Yeah, he's just and a when Jason boy. No.
When Jason saw Mary and Beth in the trunk, he said, "Whoa." But before he could say anything more, the man grabbed him and threw him into the trunk on top of Mary and Beth.
Oh, my God. Okay, I was not anticipating that. Oh, my God.
Mary recalled, quote, "I think our abductor panicked and grabbed Jason and threw him in the trunk on top of us. The other boy saw what happened to his friend and ran home. We didn't know what had happened, and all of a sudden, the trunk is slammed, the car is started, and it peels out. It was a wild ride out of there."
Oh, my gosh.
And this is going to break your heart. It's Mary tried to comfort the young boy, but he was too scared and could barely talk through his sobs. And he was just saying that he needed to get home because he was going to visit his grandma that weekend.
Oh, my gosh. Poor baby. 6 years old. That's like Manny almost.
Yeah. So the man drove the car with Mary, Beth, and Jason all in the trunk. And he drove to the Carlos Avery Wildlife Refuge. And this was a remote area, very isolated. And once there, he pulled Jason out of the trunk and basically took him away. So Mary and Beth didn't know what was happening.
No.
Beth said, quote, "He went off for a long, long time. Then when he returned, he didn't open the trunk. And instead, he just got in the car and drove off. And this was because he had beaten Jason to death with a metal rod."
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is so fucked up. What a sick fucking man. I just cannot.
I know. The man left Jason at the refuge and drove off, finally making it to the parking lot where his van was. And this was a windowless black van that no one could see in.
Ew.
He put Mary and Beth into the van, tying them up further so that they wouldn't be able to escape. And he then drove to Sound Equipment Services, which was the electronic store that he owned.
Great.
So he went to the store and he let them inside and let them use the bathroom and gave them juice. He then blindfolded them, put them back in his van, and drove them to his family's home in Roseville. This house and his parents like weren't there. It was empty at the time, but it was like not his house. It was like his family's house.
Right.
But this house was just 6 miles from the Stauffer's apartment.
Oh my gosh.
So once at this home, it was the middle of the night. So the man had no issue like bringing them inside or, you know, he didn't have to worry about neighbors seeing or anything like that. Once inside, he placed Mary and Beth into a bedroom closet, and this closet was only 4 feet long and 21 inches wide.
Wow.
That is tiny. Yeah. He shackled and chained them together and then left them in there, locking the door so they couldn't get out.
What the fuck?
Mary later said, quote, "This closet obviously had been prepared for us because there were no clothes hanging on the rod. There were some blankets and plastic bags on the shelf, a light bulb with a pull chain, a scatter rug, and 2 small throw pillows on the floor." So clearly, they realized that this was very planned.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as he didn't just take the car, I had a feeling. I mean, I know, obviously, we're telling a story about somebody that gets, you know, something terrible happens abducted. And she survives. Yeah. So, yeah, it sounded very meticulous.
And it was. It was very planned out. Which is why I think when Jason came up, he freaked out. Like, he probably could have gotten in the car and driven away and
everything would have been fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it threw off his plan. So he freaked out and ended up throwing him in the trunk.
It's awful.
Now, the evening of May 16th was filled with worry for Irv Stauffer. He was home with his son in the evening, waiting for his wife and daughter to return from their errands. But, of course, they never did. Mary's sister Sandra had plans to come over for dinner that night, and when she arrived and there was still no sign of Mary, Irv's worry just continued to increase. He actually called the salon that the two had gone to, and they confirmed that Mary and Beth had been there, but that they had left at 4:30 p.m.
Right.
So then Irv is like, what if they got into an accident or got hurt? So he started calling local hospitals, trying to figure out if they were anywhere. And then he also called some of the other missionary colleagues who all lived in the apartment building that they lived in. to see if anybody had seen Mary and Beth.
Right.
But after finding no sign of them, nobody had seen or heard from them, Irv reported them missing to the police. Now, unfortunately, Jason Wilkman, the six-year-old boy, had also been reported missing. And the police didn't have enough resources to prioritize both cases.
Jeez.
So, you know, they took it seriously. They didn't write it off, but they were like a mom and daughter versus a six-year-old boy.
The six-year-old boy takes precedence.
Individual six-year-old boy.
And that makes sense. I mean, I get it, but it's just heartbreaking nonetheless.
Yeah. And what's even worse is that there was a witness to Jason's disappearance. Jason's friend, who had witnessed his abduction, he had seen Jason being abducted, but he had stayed at like the front of the car. So he didn't know that Mary and Beth were in the trunk, and he had no way of knowing that. So the police hadn't connected the two. So there were like still split resources going to both of these different disappearances instead of it being like we're looking for one suspect. But there was no way that anyone could have known that it was the same.
A good look at the guy? Like did the I know he's just probably like another 5 or 6 year old little boy, but
I don't think got a good enough look.
Yeah.
Irv later said, quote, "We were not a priority. An hour or two later, an officer came by the apartment. I could sense he thought this was a domestic problem." So, you know, again, it's a mom and daughter leaving. It's not like just one person. It's not just the kid. So obviously we still need to listen to the family and be
assumptions.
But Irv said that he really felt like the police were kind of like, this isn't the priority.
Yeah.
Thankfully, by the next day, investigators actually started to connect the cases, because when they were searching the park that Jason was abducted from, they found Mary's car's license plate lying on the ground. Apparently, when the man was rushing to leave the area after unexpectedly abducting Jason, the car had hit some thick brush and the license plate had torn off of the car. So this was really fortunate for investigators, because they were able to connect.
That's divine intervention right there.
Somebody being like, these are connected.
We're going to leave some breadcrumbs.
So searches for Jason, Mary, and Beth began with over 300 authorities and volunteers from the community searching for the three of them.
Wow.
They did have a sketch of the suspect from Jason's friend who witnessed the abduction, but unfortunately no one could identify the man from the sketch. And it actually does look kind of similar. But it, you know, again, like you said, it was a young boy
who was traumatized. How much is he going to remember, you know?
And I really think it was so quick. I think as soon as Jason went around, because Mary and Beth said he literally said, "Whoa," and then that was it. He got thrown in the car. Of course, Irv was one of the initial suspects because, you know, the husband always did it. But he fully cooperated with the investigation, even taking and passing a lie detector test. So he was ruled out pretty quickly.
Okay, that's good. They didn't focus too much on that.
Yeah. So the next day, while investigators were connecting Mary and Beth's abduction with Jason's, the man finally revealed who he was and what his motive was.
Great.
So he brought Mary out of the closet that they had been in all night and placed her on a blanket in the living room, blindfolded and tied to a piece of furniture. And over the next 3 hours, he conducted a quote-unquote interview, which he videotaped, and he slowly revealed who he was.
An interview?
Mm-hmm.
Like asking her questions?
Kind of. So he said to her, quote, "Do you remember a student who developed a formula for an algebra problem?" And that was when Mary realized who this was.
One of her students?
Yeah. Ming Sen Shu had been one of her students in her 9th grade math class at Ramsey High School in 1966, 14 years earlier.
Holy shit. What the? That is terrifying.
Yeah.
She didn't recognize him.
No, because he was in 9th grade.
Years,
he was.
Yeah.
Like, how old are you in 9th grade? Like, 14? And now he's 29, 28, 29. Like,
Wow.
So, let's back up and talk a little bit about this man. Meng Sen Xu was born on October 15th, 1950 in Taiwan. When he was 8 years old, Xu, his two siblings, and his parents moved to Minnesota after his father got a job as a professor at the University of Minnesota. Xu was described as a troubled child and teen. So as a kid, he was violent towards his siblings, beating them often. And when they were teenagers, he continued to kind of do these same types of things and even into adulthood. As a teenager, Xu was caught committing several crimes, including starting fires in apartments and throwing rocks at vehicles. When he was just 14 years old, he was caught for an arson that he committed, and he was ordered to participate in psychotherapy instead of, like, going to, you know, a juvenile facility or jail. He was, like, in psychotherapy, but that did little to help. Xu's mother would later describe him as having no feelings, saying that he, quote, often lied but was persistent about being right, was uncontrollable as a child, and took no responsibilities for his physical behavior. She went as far to say that she was scared of him.
Wow, that is not good.
So Meng Sen Xu attended Ramsey High School in Roseville, Minnesota from 1965 to 1966, and that's when he met Mary Stauffer, his ninth grade algebra teacher. Now, when his identity was revealed to Mary, she did, like, remember him, but didn't recall having any issues with him as a student, saying he didn't cause any problems and was not memorable for anything bad he did. So it kind of seems like it was one of those where she's like, oh yeah, like, I kind of vaguely remember him, but, like,
yeah, I mean, you can't remember every student you have unless they make an impact, and clearly he didn't, so.
Yeah, exactly, and he was a quote-unquote normal student, so, like, nothing to think about, nothing to worry about, but unfortunately, he was slowly becoming obsessed with Mary during the school year. He later would confess that he had become infatuated with his teacher, even going as far as to sexually fantasize about her during class.
I mean,
it happens.
It does happen, but given everything else, that is the problematic part of it.
This was more of, like, an obsession, not just a, like, oh, my teacher's hot.
Like an infatuation, like unhealthy, not just teenage, like, angst and hormones.
Exactly. And it went on for years following that school year. And his obsession just continued to escalate. When Mary returned from her first four-year trip to the Philippines and was back in Minnesota in 1975, he began stalking her.
What? So he's been stalking her the whole time for 14 years when she was in the U.S.?
No, for 5 years.
Oh, for 5 years. Yeah. Okay, okay. Yeah. I was like, whoa.
Once he was like an adult.
Okay.
Now, actually, while Mary and Irv were away in the Philippines, Xu had an encounter with Irv's parents. So he confused Irv's father, who was also named Irv Stauffer, with Irv, Mary's husband, because, you know, same name. On the 4th of July, he broke into their home and held Irv at gunpoint and forced him to call his wife into the room.
What?
But when Mary's mother-in-law came in instead of Mary, Xu realized his mistake, and then he tied Mary's in-laws up at gunpoint and, according to Irv, quote, threatened them that if they ever called the police, he would come back and shoot them.
Shit.
He then locked them in a bedroom downstairs, and they never reported this to the police because they were terrified of him. And they also never told Mary and Irv about the incident, likely because they were afraid of what she would do.
Wow. That's insane. I can't, like, I want to be like, maybe they could have stopped him. But then at the same time, it's like, you're fearing for your life, you know.
Yeah, and probably, like,
what do you do in that situation?
They were probably fearful for Mary and Irv and their grandchildren too. Like, they were probably like, you know, he only threatened to come back and shoot us, but if he finds out, he might hurt them too.
Right.
Xu actually admitted that he had done this to Mary's in-laws during that interview that he did with her.
Oh my God.
So in 1979, when Mary and Irv returned from the Philippines for the 1 year furlough between then and when they were going to go back in 1980, Shu continued to stalk them. So he was able to learn that they had moved into an apartment building in Arden Hills, Minnesota. And once he found their apartment building, he ramped up his surveillance of the family. He would literally sit in the woods outside of the building spying on them. So he was able to learn where they left their spare key.
No.
He watched what they did. He was like literally stalking them.
That is terrifying. That could literally happen to anybody and you'd have no idea because you're just living your life.
Yeah. And he's just sitting in the woods. And he even attempted to break into the apartment at one point. He apparently used a blowtorch to break in through the patio doors.
Ew.
Don't know how that was going to work, buddy, but he tried, but it didn't work. Ugh. So then he went to the Mary and Irv's apartment, or the Stauffer's apartment was like not on the bottom floor, but I don't think there was an apartment under them. And so he was able to access like the ceiling that was their floor. And he stood on a storage area that was beneath their unit and literally tried to cut holes, drill holes into their apartment.
Oh my God.
And this ended up being underneath Mary and Irv's bed. And he ended up leaving sawdust under the bed that Irv later swept up, not thinking anything of it. Because he was probably just like, oh, it's just dust. Weird.
Yeah.
So he had been planning this for a while. And during the interview, Shu told Mary, quote, "You were lucky that I got you when I did, with a minimum of your family exposed, because I would have done anything to take you."
I'm appalled.
Yeah.
Just appalled.
Yeah. So she was still like, okay, you're obsessed with me, but why are you doing this?
Like, what are you doing? Yeah, what are you going to do to me? Like, what's next? What's your end goal, buddy?
And what is leading you to do this other than your obsession? Like, why do you want to have me?
Yeah.
So he told her that he got a B grade in her class. And that was a, quote, blemish on his otherwise spotless record. And because of that, he was unable to receive an academic scholarship. He told her that because of that B in her class, he couldn't attend college because he couldn't afford college without a scholarship. And he said that without that scholarship and being able to attend college, he was drafted into the Vietnam War and ended up in a prisoner of war camp. And this was all her fault.
Okay. First of all, not her fault. Second of all, you should have done better. Maybe. Third of all, a B is pretty damn good. Our colleges are not accepting people for Bs. Like, what the fuck? I mean, I know you get scholarships if you have like whatever, but
it doesn't make sense because none of it was true.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, they go off your GPA, not a B
yeah.
in one of your classes.
Yes. So he did, I think, get a B in that class, but he was not in the Vietnam War. He was not in a POW camp. He, like, none of this was true.
What?
He was actually an exceptional student and ended up being the number one student in his high school class. So it's believed that he would have been able to receive any scholarship to many mm-hmm. different colleges had he actually tried to apply.
And then it's like, are you mad at her and you want revenge, or are you obsessed with her and you want to marry her and have a family, or yeah, whatever your fantasy is? It
feels like he was obsessed but felt like he needed a quote unquote better excuse, and so that's why he yeah. came up with this whole like B grade thing
narrative.
Yeah, narrative. Yeah. Thank you. That's a good word. Now,
I'm on it tonight. I don't know.
You are. He was even voted most likely to succeed in high school. So, like, don't even.
Wow. And that really, that superlative went right down the drain.
Yeah. But he also attended the University of Minnesota, at least for some time, and ended up starting an electronics store. So, by all accounts, he seemed to be pretty successful in life.
Yeah, just mentally unwell, which is sad, but also you could get help. I mean, I guess it's the 80s. So,
yeah. You know,
men didn't do that back then, but yeah. No excuses. No excuses.
Yeah. No, not at all. And like I said, he had never served in the military either.
Yeah, that's weird to just throw that in there. Like, eh, I know, shits and gigs. Let's just throw. I was a POW.
I know. How do you go from a B grade to, okay, I couldn't get a scholarship. And because of that, I was in the military. And then I ended up being taken as a POW. Like, no, just how disrespectful.
Yeah, sounds like he was on a shitty path from the gay. Yeah. From like the get-go.
He was getting
though,
in trouble as a kid.
Yeah, beating up his siblings, like, the fuck?
Yeah. Mary later said, quote, he knew he hadn't failed. He knew he was number one in his class. He knew that he had attended college. He knew he had never been in the military. But it had to be a plausible story that I would feel some regret for how badly I treated him in class.
Deranged.
And he continued to run with this story. He told Mary that he was going to get revenge on her in a three-step plan, telling her, quote, I don't want your scars to be physical. I want them to be emotional. I want you to feel dirty, debased, and degraded.
Ew.
And just a trigger warning here, we will be talking about sexual assault, so skip ahead like a minute if you need to. Shu then videotaped 6 hours worth of raping Mary.
Like consistent rape?
More or less, it seems like.
Oh my god. Was she still blindfolded at this point?
Or? So I think she was not. And thankfully, Beth was not in the room.
Yeah, thank god.
Didn't have to witness any of this.
Wow.
He eventually was forced to return the video camera that he had taken out on loan. So there was no more video recording of this, but he continued to rape her every single day that he held her captive.
So sick.
Like I said, thankfully he never touched Beth and did not make her watch, but he would continually threaten that he would either touch her or make her watch what was happening.
That makes me really sad too, because like she's such a devout Christian, and like she, the only person she's probably ever been with was her husband.
Yeah.
And to steal that innocence from her, or whatever you want to call it, like that is just,
and that's
heartbreaking
exactly
on a whole other level.
What he wanted to do. He was doing that purposefully.
Yeah, I'm sure he was. Calculated sick fuck.
Yeah. So over the next month and a half that Shu held Mary and Beth captive, he not only physically abused Mary, but he also emotionally and mentally manipulated both her and her daughter.
A month, you said?
53 days.
Oh my god.
Yeah. At one point, he was mad that Mary was not participating in his fantasies willingly and told her to be more loving toward him.
Ew.
The next part I'm going to read directly from what Mary would later say to the Twin Cities Pioneer Press, which is a really well done story on this case, and I will link it in our sources. But I just want to read this directly from what Mary said. Quote, I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I love my husband and I promise to be true to him until death, and what you ask, I cannot do. So he got this big, clear plastic bag and said, have you ever watched someone die by suffocation? You're going to watch your daughter die by suffocation.
No.
He put this plastic bag over her whole body as she sat in the closet. He tucked it underneath her and said, it'll take 4 to 5 minutes. She'll gradually breathe up all the oxygen and then she'll die.
Oh my god.
Beth said, Mom, what does he want you to do? I said, he wants me to sin. Beth said, oh, Mom, don't sin. But please, can I come out from under this bag? Because it's so hot in here.
That's like making my heart hurt.
I could see the perspiration running down her face and the bag was contracting around her face. It was horrible. I don't have words to describe it. So she was terrified. She knew that he was going to let Beth suffocate, and he also threatened that he would kill her husband and son if she didn't comply. So she was forced to give her abductor a peck on the cheek. But he said, that's not enough. Mary said, so I gave him a peck on the lips, and that was enough to get him to take the bag off Beth. Quote, what followed was the most horrible of rape sessions, but at least Beth was safe.
Yeah.
Literally such a fucking monster.
Yeah.
So Shu held Mary and Beth captive for 7.5 weeks. 53 days they were locked in that closet, tormented mentally and Mary physically as well. Shu, during this time, made Mary write letters to her husband to quote-unquote convince him that she had left on her own accord.
Wow.
But as time went on, Shu kind of started to relax some. So he started letting them eat in the kitchen instead of in the closet. He would play board games with them and let them watch TV. He even started calling Beth Bethy, which is like so sick, but it really...
Fuck off.
Yeah, like it feels like he really was living this like fantasy of this is my family.
Right. This is my wife. This is my child. And everything is hunky-dory.
It's like, no, it's fucking not.
Yeah, they're just getting by, dude.
Beth would later say, quote, he was weirdly affectionate in a sick parental way. It was icky then and it's creepy now.
Yeah.
After about a month, Shu actually took Mary and Beth out. He took them on a road trip to a job fair in Chicago. And his plan was to take them on this road trip as his family.
That's brave.
Yeah. So before this road trip, he had to take them to the mall because Mary and Beth were still wearing the same clothes that they were abducted in a month earlier. So he took them to the mall in Madison, Wisconsin. And while they were out, he kept Beth like right by his side under the threat that if either of them said anything, he would basically kill Beth.
Yeah.
Mary did try to secretly alert somebody. She actually, at one of the stores, used a traveler's check that she had in her purse in the hopes that the bank would be notified of its use.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, despite Irv having told the FBI about the check in the early days of the investigation, they were not alerted when it was used. The FBI wasn't. So it's unclear, like, why, where there was, like...
What happened? Yeah.
But...
Because her husband was getting the letters, right? Or no?
He was. He didn't believe them. Okay. He knew that they weren't true, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. While out at some point on this trip, Beth was actually left alone in the van. And in a moment of bravery, as she described, she called out to a group of teenage boys that she had been kidnapped. But she said, quote, they basically laughed at me and told me to stop making up stories and went on their way.
Stupid teenage boys, man.
Yeah. And unfortunately, they weren't able to get away long enough at any point during this trip to tell anyone that they had been kidnapped. They even were taken to a park on the 4th of July. They were taken to a restaurant and to the University of Minnesota campus, but every time they were out in public, they weren't able to get away long enough to say anything.
That's so frustrating because you're like, oh, I'm so close to freedom.
Like you're in public, you're around people.
Yeah. No one's catching what I'm laying, I'm throwing, what I'm laying down.
And he was like majorly threatening them. So it makes sense why they didn't want to do anything too intense.
Yeah. Especially as a mother, like you're not going to do anything to jeopardize your child's safety. So, yeah.
Mary kept a terrified Beth and herself optimistic through this all, hoping that they would eventually be freed. She did so by talking about stories from the Bible, and they really leaned on their faith. Mary said, quote, our job was not to understand what was happening. It was to trust that the Lord was going to work this out in his own way, in his own time. In July, about 7 weeks into their captivity, Shu bought a camper for the three to live in because he said he couldn't keep staying at his family's home because eventually, unclear where his parents were, but eventually they would return. I was
going to say, maybe they were...
They could have been back home.
Maybe they were in Taiwan or something. Yeah. So I was going to ask that. Like, how is he keeping them, locked up in his room? But then you said he was eating in the kitchen and stuff. Or they were eating in the kitchen.
They were, like, in the whole house. Like, nobody else was in the house.
Okay.
But eventually he was like, I can't do this forever. So he bought a camper. And on the morning of July 7th, Shu left for work, like always. But this time when he was gone, Mary noticed that the cable that had tied her and Beth together was also through the top hinge of the closet door. Now, he had done this basically to allow them to, like, move through the room more freely than just being locked in the closet.
Right.
And this day, she realized, that's just over the hinge. I could pull that out. and we wouldn't be attached to the closet anymore. So after 53 days in captivity, this was their chance. Mary recalled that when she was a kid, her father would take hinge pins out of doors to, like, take them off, fix them, whatever.
Yeah.
So she knew that this could happen. And while she didn't have a hammer like her father used, she had determination. She started hitting the pin in the top hinge to force it up, and it worked. She would later say it lifted out like it was greased.
Wow, that gave me goosebumps.
Yeah. Once they were sure that Shu had left the house, they freed themselves from the cable that was attaching them to the closet and immediately ran to the phone, calling the sheriff's office. They were put on hold twice before they were finally able to speak to someone.
The 80s.
Yeah. And but in that time, Mary found a dry cleaning tag in the closet, or she might have found it before. Either way, she had found this dry cleaning tag in the closet, and that had the address of the house on it. So she had something to tell the police, like, where they were. When Sergeant Mike Fowler finally picked up the phone, Mary said, quote, "This is Mary Stauffer, the Arden Hills kidnap victim, and I would like someone to come get us."
Oh my gosh. That's like giving me flashbacks to when, like, the Cleveland kidnappings, like when they called.
Yeah. It was giving me the same.
This is Amanda Berry.
Yeah. Oh, chills.
I know.
One of the first things that Fowler said back to her was, quote, "Is Jason with you?" And Mary recalled that that's when she realized that the young boy had been killed. Because they didn't know. He was just taken out of the car.
That confirmed it for sure. Yeah. That's so sad. I wish he was. I wish he did just get taken with him.
I know.
Them.
But unfortunately, he didn't. But now Mary and Beth were almost safe. So after making the call, they ran out of the house and they hid behind an old car that was sitting outside. And at this point, they were still tied together with cables. So they had, like, gotten themselves free from the cable that attached them to the closet, but they were still tied together. And there's actually a picture of them shortly after their escape still tied together that I will share because it is so scary.
I'm gonna look it up while you talk.
And they were terrified that Shu would return and figure out they had called the police and hurt them before help could arrive. So they were literally crouching down behind a car waiting for the police to come. Thankfully, he didn't return and the police were able to come save them.
Thank God.
As it so happened, right as Mary and Beth had escaped, Irv was on the phone with an FBI agent who was on the case talking about a third letter that her parents had received just that morning. So he was literally on the phone with an FBI agent. The agent got the news that there was a phone call made to the police, but, you know, they weren't able to confirm it all yet. But he told Irv that something was transpiring, didn't give him any further details. And then not long after that, a deputy arrived at the Stauffer's apartment to bring Irv and Steve to the sheriff's office and to tell them that Mary and Beth had been found alive.
Oh, I'm going to cry. I'm crying.
I know. So after the escape, the FBI raided Shu's electronics store that he owned where he worked. He was working just like any other day, and they arrived, raided it, arrested him, and put him in jail.
I hope they, like, threw his ass on the ground and, like, put their knee so deep into his back that
honestly, they probably did.
I hope to God they did.
Yeah, they probably did. His tirade did not stop there, though.
Of course not.
Shortly after his arrest, Shu tried to get his original cellmate, a man named Richard Green, who was being released from jail shortly after Shu was arrested, to kill Mary and Beth so that they couldn't testify against him.
Are you joking?
Yeah.
What in the fuck?
Quote, Shu mailed the ex-inmate a $1,000 check with the promise of another $50,000 after the deeds were done. So he was trying to get this ex-inmate that was, like, his cellmate for a couple days to
hitman.
Yeah, be a hitman and kill Mary and Beth, and then also to get to help him escape.
Oh, geez.
According to the formal district court report, Green admitted to the contract, but not until after a second FBI interview and after the FBI monitored Shue's finances and knew about the payment. So, like, he admitted to it, but, like, not right away.
So he was, like, he's gonna take his money and just be like,
that's what I'm
you,
thinking. And then, I think he was probably gonna try to just take the $1,000 and, like, run away with it, but he did admit to it.
Okay.
They honestly probably threatened that, like, he would get in more trouble if he didn't admit to it.
Well, yeah. Hopefully he wasn't contemplating it. Jesus.
So obviously this didn't work, and Ming Senshu was charged with kidnapping on the federal level because he transported Mary and Beth across state lines. And then at the state level, he was charged with the sexual assault, kidnapping, and the murder of Jason Wilkman. This man had the audacity to plead not guilty.
No. Based on what? Please, based on what?
There is no evidence that you are not guilty, but he pleaded not guilty. Yeah. He went to trial, and badass Mary testified at his trial.
Good. Good.
So his federal trial was first, and when Mary was going up to testify, she was walking up, and when you walk up in court, you walk up through the gallery, and then you have to basically walk between the defense table and the prosecution table. When she was doing that, Shu tried to lunge at her to try to hurt her. Thankfully,
in the courtroom?
In the courtroom. Thankfully, the prosecutor was in the way and blocked his path, Shu's path to her, and the marshals were able to, like, tackle him down before he could do anything. But
oh my god, what a fucking idiot. Also, look at the little boy.
Oh, I know, Jason.
He's so sad.
I know. I'll post a picture of him for you guys to see, because his little face.
So sweet.
I know. So the federal trial was just for, like, kidnapping and, you know, transporting across state lines. And that lasted 10 days. And the jury ended up finding him guilty of the kidnapping of Mary and Beth Stauffer. And he was sentenced to life with no chance of parole for at least 30 years.
No chance of parole, period. Yeah. I'm sorry. I just, like, fucking do not get that, dude. Like, you killed a little boy. You raped an innocent woman and held her poor daughter
captive. And unfortunately the federal trial was just for the kidnapping. Don't worry, he does go to trial for the murder. True. But still,
okay
30 years, like, you're just gonna freaking do this again.
Yeah, definitely some other person that gave you a B one day or something,
right? So Shu was charged at the state level for the kidnapping and murder, and he reportedly admitted to a psychiatrist that, you know, did, like, a exam of him, that he knew where Jason's body was, because they still hadn't found Jason. They didn't know where he was. They just presumed he was dead because he wasn't with Mary and Beth, so where else would he be? He refused to tell them where Jason was. And because they really wanted to find Jason, they offered Shu a plea deal where they would downgrade the murder charge to second-degree murder in exchange for him leading them to his body, to Jason's body.
Well, technically, wouldn't it be second-degree murder since it wasn't premeditated?
It might have been, honestly.
Or I guess it's different in different states. So.
Yeah, that's true. But, yeah. So Shu ended up agreeing to this plea deal, and in late October of 1980, they found Jason Wilkman's body. And that's when they determined that his cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head.
What a fucking foul, disgusting human being to look a child in the face and do that to them.
I know.
I hope he got beat the fuck up, like, every day in prison.
I know.
Yeah.
Oh, and it gets worse. So Mary, once again, testified at Shu's state trial. And once again, Shu tried to attack her. And this time, he was actually able to hurt her.
Why did they not fucking, what?
Shackle him?
How?
I know.
Yeah. Or how about bring him in first and then bring her in later and shackle him to the fucking.
So this time, he was, when she was testifying, like, up on the stand, he jumped at her, was able to get a hold of her, and had a knife that he smuggled in up to her throat. And he was threatening, quote, "Get back or I'll kill her."
And nobody shot him?
Right? Thankfully, a
police... I would have fucking shot him. Sorry.
Well, he was probably holding her in front of him so that she was like a shield. But thankfully, there was a police lieutenant that was outside of the courtroom waiting to testify. And when he heard the commotion, he ran up and was able to grab Mary away from Shu. So Mary was safe, but she had to get 62 stitches in her face because of the attack.
I know. I saw the scar when I was looking up the pictures of them and the cables. I saw the scarring on her face. I was wondering when that happened, because you didn't mention it during the, you know, abuse and stuff. So,
damn. It was during the trial when she was freaking testifying against him. So they literally had to, like, postpone the trial, like, delay it and take a break from it so that she could
go get stitches. She had to recover.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fuck?
Yeah. But ultimately, Ming Sen Shu was found guilty of kidnapping and second-degree murder at the state level, and he was sentenced to 40 years to be served concurrently with his federal life sentence. In April 1981, Shu appealed his federal conviction, claiming that comments made during the trial by the prosecution prevented him from having a fair trial, and that there was insufficient evidence relating to his insanity defense, which he had tried to do.
Shut up.
He said that had more evidence been collected, he would have been able to use that insanity defense. Thankfully, his plea was denied. His conviction was upheld.
And why are they giving him a concurrent sentence when these are two different? I will never understand our justice system. I will never.
It makes ever no ever sense.
Understand it.
No, it makes no sense.
How about No. Mm-mm.
In 2010, Shu reached that 30-year minimum amount of time to be in prison before being considered for parole.
Mm-mm.
Prior to his parole hearing, psychologist Paul Reitman evaluated now 60-year-old Shu in 2010. Not now, but in 2010 he was 60.
Yeah.
He evaluated him for hours, and he ultimately determined that he was still a threat to the community.
Good.
So in his report, Reitman said he would be concerned if Shu was released, saying, quote, "He's a very tormented man because he is delusional. He goes from one aspect of being delusional, being nice, let's go on a family trip. It just represents moral chaos. His psychological life is hell."
Good. I hope it is. I hope he's tormented.
Mm-hmm. Reitman also said he might feel that he spent 30 years in prison because she lied. We don't know that, but that's why he has to be scrutinized in intensive psychological treatment, as well as sex offender treatment.
Yeah.
In 2010, the judge ultimately denied his parole and also ruled that if he is ever paroled, he has to be committed to a state sex offender program. That's basically, it's not just like registering as a sex offender, it's like a program, so he will never be free.
Okay.
He has continued to apply for parole, but he has repeatedly been denied.
As he should be. He should never, ever, 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 ever be freed. Ever. No.
Mary said after his parole hearing in 2010 that Shu had told her that if he was ever caught and then released, like when they were, when he held her captive, he told her, if I'm ever caught and released, he would take revenge on the family.
Yeah. I believe he would.
Quote, he said, "Don't think that even if I get caught and put in prison for 25 years, don't think I will forget about you. When I get out, I will go after you. And if you're dead, I will go after your kids." So thankfully, it does seem like the parole board is listening to this and, you know, taking this seriously and listening to the psychologist and like not letting him out. But
yeah. No, he should never get out. If they let him out, that they are doing a huge disservice to not only the stalkers, but every single solitary person that man has ever come in contact with.
Yeah. And, like, that would be so terrifying for her family.
Yeah. And that's not fair to them.
No.
They've been through enough.
Ming Sen Shu is currently imprisoned at a medium security federal prison in Marion, Illinois. And at 73 years old today, it is unlikely he will ever be paroled. The Stauffer family returned to the Philippines in 1981 once Mary and Beth were safe and Shu was in prison. They said that getting out of the country allowed them to reclaim a sense of normalcy in their life.
Yeah.
After that trip, they returned to the United States and retired in Mary's childhood home.
No.
Beth, who is now a mother herself, said, quote, "Shu said he didn't want to leave physical scars, just emotional. He took 53 days of our lives. If I let him have one more, evil wins, and I'm not going to let that happen." Mary has said that despite all the trauma that her family went through at the hands of Shu, he remains in their prayers. She said, "We continue to pray for him because God is so merciful. I have not felt the need to reach out to him. I just felt that that would be unwise to make any sort of contact with him. But he remains in her prayers." Which is just a testament to how strong she is.
Yeah, and how good of a person she is. Because your girl right here, on the other hand, I don't think I could be doing all that. I mean, I might, you know, I might pray for him, but maybe just like once.
Maybe just once. I mean, yeah. Mary and Beth are so freaking strong.
So strong, courageous.
Yeah. They went through something so unimaginable, but the fact that they came out the other side and Mary testified the second time after he attacked her, and then he attacked her again, like, oh, I'm just so thankful that they were safe, that they were able to escape, and that, you know, they are, it seems like, recovering. Like I said, Beth is now a mother herself, and it just seems like they're living the best life that they can.
And her and her husband are okay, and they are still...
Yeah, it seems like everything...
Because I know that can really,
you know,
mix things up in a terrible way.
In that Twin Cities article that Mary and Beth were interviewed for, there's like pictures of her and Irv, and they're like so freaking adorable. Aww. So, no, it seems like are living the best life that they can. Yeah.
Yeah.
And hopefully the monster that is Ming Sen Shu will never get out of prison. I mean, he's 73 years old, so hopefully he's just like miserable, living an awful life, and will have to live like
getting beat up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is the survival story of Mary and Beth Stauffer. It is insane that they went through all of that and they were able to escape. I mean, just how terrifying is that to even make the decision to escape?
I know. And then have to sit the like being put on hold twice.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
What?
I know.
Wow.
I know. And the unfortunate murder of Jason Wilkman. It's just that poor little boy. But at least he, you know, has justice and his family was able to lay him to rest. But just so senseless, this man. It just shows how much of a monster Shu was.
Yeah. I mean, God, to just do that without a thought.
Yeah.
Could have let that little boy go.
Yeah. But that's all I have for you guys today. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you next time with a brand new episode. And until then, keep it human.
Bye, guys.